Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Combat Rock from Sleater-Kinney and their album One Beat. Really remarkable song, remarkable group. Recently ended their formation as Sleater-Kinney. It was a sad day, I think, for anybody who really cares about music that matters. At any rate, they left behind quite a bit to listen to and to think about, including this song, Combat Rock, and that album, One Beat. Really remarkable album. I want to let you know this show is going to be, hopefully, quick-moving in the sense of, because we got a lot to cover. And we have, at the back end of the show, we'll be talking with David Lindorf, Philadelphia-based journalist and columnist, who just wrote a piece on the case for the impeachment of Barack Obama. And guess what? It's exactly the same as the case for the impeachment of George Bush et al. So we'll be digging into that a little bit. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Alan Goodman from Revolution Newspaper about what the hell is going on between the U.S. and Israel, and how does it fit in, and what the U.S. is doing in the world today. And opening up the show is something that came to my attention a couple weeks ago, and I've been looking for a moment to get this in because I think it is extremely important. Feminist Majority sent out a letter to people all over the country warning them that there was a new assault going on in abortion clinics in Charlotte, North Carolina, and in particular, the Family Reproductive Health Clinic in Charlotte. And they called on people to step up and defend doctors, patients, and staff. And they made this a nationwide call, and they revealed that Operation Rescue is targeting this clinic as part of a national campaign called Storm the Gates of Hell. And I think it also has an added sort of subtitle, which is something like Unsheath the Sword, you know, which gives you a sense of the danger and all that's concentrated up in that. And joining us to talk about this situation is Catherine Spiller, who is the Executive Vice President of Feminist Majority Foundation. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You issued this call for people to defend the clinic in Charlotte, and it was in light of this new campaign by Operation Rescue, Operation Save America. What is this campaign?
Operation Rescue, Operation Save America moved its headquarters from Dallas, Texas to Charlotte, North Carolina, several years ago now, with the stated intention to close down this family reproductive health clinic in Charlotte, which is one of the major providers of abortion and family planning services in that city, and have been torturing this clinic and threatening its doctors and its staff for years, but has become very intensified since really the 2008 election. Shortly after the elections, in fact, we documented and began to see a rise in extremist threats against doctors and clinics all over the country. Clearly, they had lost the elections and were returning to a campaign of violence and intimidation. And this clinic in particular has been a focus. Most recently, in a very frightening move, Operation Rescue, Operation Save America has printed and distributed wanted posters on the doctors who work at this clinic, as well as a couple of other clinics in the city. The wanted posters feature their pictures in full color. By the way, three of the doctors featured on these wanted posters are African-American or Asian-American. They have distributed these flyers, wanted posters, at the doctors' homes, going up to the front doors of the homes and knocking on the doors, terrorizing the families, their families. They've distributed them all throughout the neighborhoods where the doctors live. They've distributed them at the doctor's private OBGYN offices in a hospital office complex, going floor to floor, going inside the doctor's offices, saying that the doctors have to quit providing abortion services, leaving the impression, you know, quit or else. And they've flyered the clinic in the neighborhood that the clinic is in. So clearly an escalation, because in the mid-90s, you may remember, and your listeners may remember, these kinds of wanted posters appeared on doctors in Florida who were later murdered by anti-abortion extremists. So we're very concerned about this turn of events and are working with the clinic to increase its own security and urging that law enforcement take all appropriate precautions and measures. And we wanted our supporters nationwide to know about not only what's happening at the clinics, but also about the work of our clinic access project.
Now, this situation that you're describing, I mean, I was really, really struck by the similarities between these wanted posters and the whole atmosphere that's being created, and the fact that this same thing had happened when these three abortion providers were killed. You know, and to me, the idea, it's the whole campaign that Operation Rescue, Operation Save America is launching this summer, which and it's from July 17th to July 24th. They're going to have a concerted effort to actually shut down the clinic in Charlotte, but to really, it seems like it's a major assault. And believe me, I went to their website, and these people are certifiably lunatics. They're certifiable lunatics. When you look at this, I mean, the Nazi iconography with tied in with the Jesus on the cross, and Jesus is the standard. And the whole way they call this, storm the gates of hell and unsheath the sword, really seems to to purposely highlight and create an atmosphere of, it highlights the danger that's out there, but it also should say something to us that part of that danger is the atmosphere that they're whipping up around this, and how they plan to actually carry out this kind of assault in terms of really whipping people up into a frenzy to storm the gates of hell.
Well, it is very violent rhetoric. There's no question about that. And this kind of rhetoric around the issue of abortion clinics and doctors and this extremist anti-abortion movement, we feel does contribute to the climate of violence and the threats and intimidation that we are witnessing nationwide. And, of course, all of this comes, you know, on the heels of the brutal murder of Dr. George Tiller in Wichita, Kansas. Very much similar kinds of rhetoric used to describe his practice and to instigate demonstrations outside his clinic and outside his church, and that, you know, kind of very intensified campaign that ultimately did result in one of the extremists killing him. So we're very concerned, and you're seeing this kind of extremist activity among militias, for example, again. And these militias are interrelated with some of these extremist anti-abortion groups and individuals. There's crossover among their membership. And so when you're seeing this kind of escalation in activity by the militias and outside reproductive health clinics, there is cause for grave concern that this extremist politics is now becoming very violent and adopting the rhetoric of violence.
Now, you talked about Operation Rescue, Operation Save America, torturing the Family Reproductive Health Clinic in Charlotte over the years. Can you talk about what they've done?
I use the word torture because I know that's what it would seem like to any neutral individual from the outside looking on. There are constant, almost daily protests at the clinic. The clinic's property is repeatedly trespassed on. The driveway that leads into the clinic's parking lot is frequently protesters walking back and forth very slowly so that cars have to come to a full stop. The doctors and the clinic staff who are driving into the lot come to a full stop and within very close proximity to these anti-abortion demonstrators who are there. The clinic even built a 6-foot wooden fence, a privacy fence, around its parking lot and around the clinic property itself in an effort to shield some of the yelling and screaming at the patients that goes on by these demonstrators and the yelling at the clinic staff and the doctors. And instead of respecting the privacy of this clinic, the anti-abortion demonstrators have erected scaffolding and 6-foot-tall ladders that they climb up on so that they can peer over the fence, and they use amplified sound equipment to yell at patients and to yell at doctors and clinic staff as they're approaching the front door of the clinic. You can even hear this amplified sound and the yelling and screaming inside the clinic. And this is a healthcare facility, first and foremost. These are not only abortion procedures that are performed, but all kinds of medical procedures, STD screening, gynecological exams, birth control, counseling. So you have a medical facility that is under constant assault, both verbally and with protesters. So it does feel, I know, almost like torture to the clinic. And they can't understand why the protesters have been allowed to literally trespass constantly on their property. And that's the issue right now in Charlotte. In fact, the attorneys for the clinic have gone into court to ask that the court order these protesters across the street, onto the sidewalk, across the street. There's not even a sidewalk on the side of the clinic. This is the clinic's property that is being trespassed on. So they would like to have the court issue an order that puts the protesters across the street where they can have their freedom of speech, but that they have to abide by noise and sound regulations that would accompany any healthcare facility, and they can no longer trespass on the clinic's property to try and block the entrance of doctors and patients and clinic staff.
A quick reminder, I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Catherine Spillar, the Executive Vice President of the Feminist Majority Foundation, about the Operation Rescue, Operation Save America campaign that they're going to launch in July 17th to July 24th in Charlotte, North Carolina, to shut down the Family Reproductive Health Clinic. But it's a campaign that, as Catherine's been telling us, has been amped up in high gear for quite some time, and it's a very dangerous and threatening thing. And, you know, Catherine, let me ask you this. I know that you're saying that, well, we're not trying to shut them down in terms of what they're speaking, but these people, this is not a free speech issue. These are people, these are Nazis that are standing out there, and in the guise of their fundamentalist religious fervor, they're standing out there, and their assault on these abortion clinics concentrates a huge program that's aimed at reducing women, first and foremost, to nothing but walking uteruses. And it's trying to rob women of their humanity. And they are bound and determined to do that. The total subjugation of women is what seems to me to be the program here. In light of that, can you talk about how this, because this is not just in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is something that I think is really, you know, has to be situated in light of what's going on overall. And in particular, I did want to ask your thoughts on the recent conviction and the sentencing of the fascist that killed Dr. Tiller.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that this is a nationwide campaign by anti-abortion extremists. In fact, there are clinics in some 14 states across the country: Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Michigan, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Pennsylvania. I could go on. These clinics are under severe threats and activity by anti-abortion extremists in those areas. And many of these extremists are connected in a loose network where they work together to plan these kinds of activities. And so it isn't just Charlotte, North Carolina. It is not just Wichita, Kansas. In fact, nationwide, even in states where you would think, what's the problem? We are seeing this kind of activity, and it's escalated since the elections. There is no question. In fact, if you remember back under the Bush administration, the violence dropped to very little. I mean, there were no murders during that period. There were no clinic bombings during that period that injured people, although we still saw a level of harassment that is really unacceptable. It's one in every five clinics, even during the years of the Bush administration, being harassed and experiencing some violence, either vandalism on the clinic or threats of violence against the individuals. We're now seeing that escalate, and of course have had a murder already. So we are very concerned. We need people to know that the problem of abortion clinic providers are not something of the past, that it's very much a threat. And the effort, as you say, is to close off access. It is to threaten and intimidate so that doctors will no longer provide abortions or that the clinics, because they're under such assault, close down. And we just can't let that happen. We have to draw a line in the sand. We have to be vigilant. We're asking people to get involved and to support our work with these clinics all across the country so that we don't see another murder and we don't see clinics closing. Women need access to these services, and it's vital for a modern society to have access to birth control and to safe abortion.
Absolutely. I want to get back into your plans in a minute, but I do want to ask you about this Roeder verdict, because, you know, one of the things that you mentioned I thought is really important, and things are rarely situated this way, when you linked both the religious mania going on with Operation Rescue, but you linked them to a broader network, including the increased activity of the militia movement, these fascist militias that are growing up, and this whole teabag party, all this other stuff that's going on. The kinds of things that are going on in the country right now really does indicate this rising tide, in a sense, of this ultra-right fascistic movement. And this abortion, this anti-abortion movement is very much tied into that.
Right. And I'm sorry I didn't address that. Roeder himself was active in the militias, in a militia in the mid to late 90s. In fact, he was arrested on a traffic stop with explosive materials in the trunk of his car, and according to press accounts, was headed to find an abortion clinic with the intention, obviously, of using the explosive materials. And I think people don't understand these interconnections. His conviction and his sentencing was very important. He was sentenced to what's called a hard 50. He won't be eligible for parole for at least 50 years. He'll be over 100 years old before he ever comes up for a parole hearing. But we're concerned that the network of extremists with whom he was actively involved for more than 15 years, they are still walking free. And we want an investigation on whether or not there was a conspiracy among these extremists with Scott Roeder to carry out this murder. And until this network of extremists is shut down and brought to justice, we're only going to see more violence. It's well known his long involvement, and we are hoping, the Department of Justice has said they are treating this as a potential conspiracy, as terrorism, and that they have a wide-ranging investigation. But it's been now almost a year since Dr. Tiller was murdered, and no federal charges have been filed. And so we must keep an eye on where that investigation is going, with the hopes that finally we will get more of this network that preaches the murder of doctors and healthcare providers, that advocates the murder of doctors and healthcare providers, that we will see this network shut down.
You know, and one of the things I think is really important in relation to this is that, you know, when you look at the Roeder trial and the verdict, in the Roeder trial, they got to put out their entire program. They got to spit their vitriol all over the place, and national platforms saying what they believed in, why they did it, and all these other things that were raised about even the consideration at a certain point of justifiable homicide or manslaughter or something like that they were talking about doing. They were given a national platform to put out this program with a bullhorn.
To the credit of the judge there, he did not allow that during the trial. He said that they're irrelevant what you believe about abortion. It's irrelevant. You cannot put on a justifiable homicide defense, which, of course, Roeder wanted to do. It was in the sentencing, the day of the sentencing, that the individual convicted has a right to plead his case and has a right to have character witnesses argue for a lesser sentence. That's the day that you heard all of this about justifiable homicide. But to the credit of the judge in Kansas, he said, no, justifiable homicide is not a defense in a first-degree murder case, and you can't put on that kind of a defense. So we saw, in fact, a very powerful prosecution that showed Mr. Roeder was long involved with this network of extremists, that for years he had stalked Dr. Tiller. He had carefully planned how he would kill him. In fact, many of the ways he described about wanting to kill Dr. Tiller are laid out in the Army of God manual. The Army of God has a manual. It is the extremist network that promotes the murder of doctors. He must have had that manual because all the different ways he talked about killing Dr. Tiller are outlined in that Army of God manual, which was seized on the arrest of an individual who tried to kill Dr. Tiller years earlier. So clearly there is a network. Clearly they are communicating and planning and promoting the idea that that doctors should be murdered, and an investigation that brings that network to justice will ultimately be the answer to this kind of violence. But in the meantime, we must defend clinics, we must mobilize community support, we must make sure that clinics have the resources they need to enhance their own security, and we've got to keep calling attention to this so that people understand we are in a very dangerous period of escalating violence against reproductive health care providers. Mm-hmm.
Now, Catherine, one final point in relation to your plans. It's important for people to know, hear the plans that you laid out. Are you also calling for people to come to Charlotte during that week that Operation Rescue is having their campaign?
Well, the community in Charlotte is mobilizing to be out at the clinics, to be legal observers, and to be there for a show of support for the clinics. More importantly, I think if people want to get involved, they can contact us at the Feminist Majority Foundation. They can come to our website. They can contribute so that we can provide the resources that the clinic and the community is going to need to mobilize. But, you know, everywhere we have worked with local communities to mobilize, it has been local citizens and local volunteers that have come forward, unlike Operation Rescue, Operation Save America, who are calling for people to come from all over the country. But if we do, if any of your listeners do have relatives or friends in Charlotte, we want them to get involved, because the show of local support is what is so important to these clinics, so that local officials and local law enforcement sees the kind of support that the clinic has in its own community. So we'd like people to get in touch with us, and we'll figure out how they can best help.
On the other hand, while I appreciate what you're saying about the importance of local people coming out, I'll tell you what, Catherine, it's like what you said earlier. This is not a Charlotte centralized thing. This is not, you know, confined that. There is a major battle going on in society over the subjugation of women, and abortion is a major part of that. And frankly, to me, it seems like there really is a basis for people everywhere to want to, like you said, draw a line in the sand and come out and defend these clinics, campaigns.
If people do want to travel to Charlotte, we will work with them to get them plugged into the efforts to defend these clinics.
There you go. All right, Catherine, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure. Take care now. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Catherine Spillar from the Feminist Majority, the Executive Vice President of the Feminist Majority. And we've been talking about Operation Rescue, Operation Save America's campaign this summer, the ongoing campaign, but the high point of it this summer between the 17th and 24th of July to shut down the abortion clinic, the Family Reproductive Health Clinic in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Alan Goodman.
See the opens on the streets of Afghanistan. I see the bones of the drones of Tajikistan. I see disease on their knees in Uzbekistan. I think we need a plan. Why do you silence the speech? I'm getting agitated. You stop to turn up the heat. I will not be dissuaded. I see the light shining.
Welcome back. That's Conspiracy of Thought with a Plan. That's a remarkable album, Conspiracy of Thought. Back into the show. I want to make sure people stay tuned for this. We're going to be having David Lindorf come on and talk about his latest article on the case for impeachment of Barack Obama. And before that, though, we are going to be joined by, in a couple of seconds here, Alan Goodman, who is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He also participated in the recent Gaza Freedom March, and he's here to talk with us today about what the hell is going on in connection with the conflict between the U.S. and Israel. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael.
Hi. Well, let's jump into this, man. One of the things that came out a couple weeks ago and sort of characterized a lot of what was being argued out in relation to the Middle East during the month of March was this sudden tiff between the U.S. and Israel. Well, basically, people are familiar with it, where the U.S. said Israel was getting them angry, was insulting them by pulling things off behind their back and without them knowing about it, and Israel saying, oh, no, we didn't mean to do that. But clearly there's something going on, and unfortunately there seems to be two assessments that are equally short of the mark. One is that this is a huge deal-breaking rift between the U.S. and Israel, and the other is that it's all smoke and mirrors created for some other purpose. Where's the truth?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it's important for us just to take a moment to ground ourselves in the basic underlying reality of what we're talking about here. You know, one of the experiences I had on the Gaza Freedom March, of course, we weren't allowed into Gaza, but I got to learn a lot about Gaza from people who had been there while we were locked down in Cairo. And I met a couple doctors who were volunteers at the Al-Wafa Hospital in Gaza shortly after Israel's massacre at the end of 08 and the beginning of 09. And this is a hospital, this is the only hospital in Gaza that treats amputees and paraplegics. And Israel shelled that hospital for 9 hours. This is not something Israel denies. This is something Israel justifies based on saying that they had left phone messages to evacuate the hospital in advance. And keep in mind, this is Gaza. These are amputees and paraplegics. And this is just one thing that's noted a little bit the UN Commission Goldstone report refutes Israel's claims that any fighters were operating out of this hospital. So this is the kind of thing, it's a concentration of what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians since its inception, with complete backing of the United States, which just, you know, time after time is often the only country in the UN that vetoes, you know, the most mild, watered-down resolutions criticizing these kinds of actions. So let's just ground ourselves in that, you know what I'm saying, before we look at this current tiff. And I can understand why people would be hoping, perhaps, that the scenario or the framework is that, well, finally, you know, they pushed Biden too far. What happened was when Biden was in Israel a few weeks ago, Israel announced some settlements as part of their ongoing ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem. And this was a, you know, awkward and embarrassing timing for the U.S. But the basic relationship, you know, I haven't heard so much the smoke and mirrors analysis. Maybe you can explain that a little bit more. But there is no fundamental rift between the United States and Israel. This is a very profound strategic relationship. You know, when I was on the hold, I was thinking of something that might be an interesting challenge for you and your listeners. Dig up any of the statements that Obama or Biden or Hillary Clinton or whatever have made in this recent period. With me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, dig them up, you know, expressing their quote-unquote anger with Israel. Every one of them will be framed in a restatement that we have a common bond with Israel, that the U.S.-Israel relationship is strategic, and on and on. And then look at the way they speak about the Palestinians if they reference them. They might reference the suffering of the Palestinian people, but only to the extent that that poses a danger to Israel's stability. So, we can talk about why this tiff is tempest in a teapot, or whatever the expression is, why, you know, it fundamentally is not, and you could explain the smoke and mirrors thing more, but why it fundamentally is not about any rift between the United States and Israel. And another metaphor that I was thinking about that we've used in Revolution newspaper in the past is that Israel is the attack dog that's trained to bite when his master says stop. So I think that shed some basic light on it,
Let me ask you this, because what I was referring to around the smoke and mirrors is there's a Krautmann actually in the New York Times had a whole thing about how Obama created this tiff. But that's one angle. But the other thing is actually there's a number of places I've read things where people were talking about, you know, this was sort of a manufactured crisis that might have. And again, it's always been cast in terms of, you know, these talks that they're trying to promote in Israel, between Israel and Palestine now, these ridiculously named proximity negotiations, which I thought was just like, wow, that's kind of amazing. The point here is there's the overall and most important thing about the strategic relationship between the U.S. and Israel is firm, full standing, and ongoing. And at the same time, there are contradictions that develop. And for instance, a lot of people were wondering, why would this housing thing become, you know, this settlement construction in East Jerusalem become such a huge thing? And it is very much tied into the what's going on between, you know, the Palestinians and the Zionist state. And Richard Falk actually said that these negotiations are, you know, he made a point about these negotiations are actually essential to the U.S. strategic plans in the Middle East and in terms of settling the Palestinian question. And what these negotiations actually come down to is really almost a formalized surrender of the Palestinian struggle. A certain sense, in the way that because of the way that the Palestinian Authority has been just slavishly capitulating to everything that they've wanted all along. And so the whole question of This being linked to this housing has much more to do with the major strategic implications for the U.S. in the region than anything else.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. And there's a lot of different levels of this, you know, and each level has its own life of its own. You know, there is, you know, there are conflicts within the Israeli ruling class, within Israel's role as a rabid attack dog for the U.S. and the Middle East. There are conflicts, but, you know, these are all subsumed, as you're referring to, in larger strategic interests, and particularly right now. You know, I've just been going back and myself rereading some of the things that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, wrote after 9/11. He had a talk called The New Situation and Great Challenges, where he basically kind of summarized all these different things that the neocons had on the shelf and pulled off the shelf, you know, whatever Rumsfeld quote was, roll it all up, related or not, to really radically reshuffle the whole situation in Central Asia and the Middle East. And right now it appears that, you know, the big conflict or the big contradiction for them in doing that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And whatever the actual state and nature of its nuclear policy, the U.S., you know, really does perceive that as a threat and could unbalance the situation, or not unbalance, but could disrupt the situation of that the U.S. is trying to establish in the Middle East. So I think that frames the overall picture. And in that context, you know, if before this little tiff about the settlements broke out, there was a whole exchange, and I don't have quotes in front of me, but essentially Biden, who was over there at the time, was saying things along the lines of, you know, I don't know how long we can hold Israel back from a nuclear strike on Iran. I mean, We're pushing negotiations. We're pushing sanctions. And by the way, sanctions do kill people. But, you know, Biden is saying statements like this, but I don't know how long I can keep Israel back. And again, the metaphor of the rabid dog on the leash that's trained to bite when his master says stop. If you sort through all the different layers of machinations going on here, this is essentially, through proxies, the U.S. delivering a threat of a nuclear attack. Israel has a substantial nuclear arsenal, or at least some kind of very major attack on Iran through Israel. So I think that's underlying a lot of this. And then there's all these other layers of contradiction that you're referring
to. Well, one of which actually I found very interesting. But before we get into that, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Alan Goodman, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about what's going on, the contradiction, the fight between the tiff between Israel and U.S. imperialism, and what the hell's going on there. Now, Alan, one of the things that actually comes out around this in relation to all this is the Petraeus statement that in one way or another was also echoed by Biden. And then you find out that Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, actually had gone over to Israel even before, you know, way back in the beginning of this year to lay out some of the same things, that actually this idea that, in terms of these contradictions, the contradictions that are also contained within the overall strategic alliance, but these contradictions that actually were coming into conflict with the U.S. imperialist strategic interests in the entire region, which I thought was very heavy. I don't know when, I can't remember another time when this kind of thing was breaking out into the open, where the CENTCOM commander or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is getting involved in this thing, saying that, look, Israel's actions are actually threatening American lives, and not really American lives, but American strategic interests in the region. Now, that's a very heavy thing in terms of all this.
Well, I think basically the way to understand that, and I didn't see that particular quote, but that there is infighting, and I don't know really the nature of it, but I'm sure there are contradictions at top levels of the U.S. government. And they may take the form of someone saying, oh, Obama provoked an incident with the housing thing in order to make a point or something like that. You know, Iran is a relatively big regional power, and it's a big deal for, you know, Israel or the United States to attack it. So it's not surprising that there's tension, you know, in the halls of power over whether, when, and how to do that. You know, one thing I would refer people to, there's a very in-depth working paper available at revcom.us on the whole situation with the contradictions between the U.S. and Iran that's helping frame this. But I think this does underlie this, and on, you know, again, there's a lot of levels of reality here. But within all these different tiffs and fights and disputes within the ruling class and accusations and who set up who and all this kind of thing, there is a general strategic consensus that nothing is going to be done to undercut Israel, its role, its stability, and its position as the only nuclear enforcer in the Middle East.
Well, that you could see, actually, that was really interesting to me because you could see it in two different formations this, over the last couple of weeks. One was the AIPAC meeting, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And I'm always ready to say Political Action Committee. I guess they named it that way purposely. Anyway, you know, Netanyahu's speech, Clinton's speech at the AIPAC thing. Netanyahu's was just an amazingly frothing, rabid, basically saying, look, if you're not going to take care of Iran, we will. Make no mistake about it. We are ready and capable of taking care of Iran. And Clinton's speech was not that far removed from that, even though she was talking about, yes, let's do this, let's have these, you know, the sanctions and all this. And I think it is important that people realize sanctions kill people. But Clinton was pretty bloodthirsty herself around that. And then you had all these senators and members of Congress who were signing these letters in support of Israel in opposition to Iran. Very heavy things going on there. And then you have this nuke conference where one of the things that comes out of it is Israel somehow managed to once again escape to keep guarded their position that their nuclear capacity is only a matter of speculation and there will be no inspection or revealing of what they actually have or don't have. And that was all in relation to Iran, which to me is a very, very, very dangerous situation right now in terms of what they all seem to be, you know, planning or moving towards, or at least holding the hammer up in the air of this assault on Iran.
Well, I think to take this back to the way we started the conversation and the question you posed, I mean, I'm sensing that there is a tremendous amount of outrage over Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. You know, more and more things start to get leaked out about what happened in Gaza during the war a year and a half ago, the ongoing situation. We were actually able to create a certain amount of public publicity and public stir around the world and even a little bit in the United States by trying to march in Gaza last December 31st. And a lot of people are trying to understand what is behind the just intransigent and unbending U.S. support for Israel. And, you know, again, at least, you know, where I have my finger on the pulse, a lot of people hoping against hope that perhaps now with this insult to the U.S., you know, that took place when Biden was over there, perhaps now Obama will wake up, that the United States will realize it's being manipulated, that the American people will stop buying into the Israel thing. And the importance of our discussion now, I think, in one dimension is that we do have to confront what we're up against here and why is it that the stability of Israel is unquestioning. You know, it has nothing to do with the Holocaust, which has no moral or logical connection. That was a terrible crime, but it has no, it in no way justifies anything Israel's doing. And, you know, what I run into a lot is, you know, well, it's the corrupting influence of the Israel lobby, and they're just so influential, and, you know, they've got the whole Jewish community behind them, or too many of them in the United States. And all that is true on a phenomenal level, but I think the things we're talking about, the geostrategic role Israel plays, is actually what we're up against, and that then poses some serious challenges for everyone who is outraged about the crimes Israel is committing against the Palestinians, and really understanding that this is not a case of the system breaking down. This is the world imperialist system at work, and if you are outraged about what is going on, you do have to take that on.
All right, Alan, a very important point, and with that, we're going to wrap this up, and I look forward to having you back again soon, maybe continue this and other things going on.
So, okay, great, right. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about what's really going on in the contradiction between the U.S. and Israel, what's really behind it, how does it relate to U.S. strategic interests in the world, and in particular in relation to Iran. I want to take a quick break and be right back with Dave Lindorf. Dave is a Philadelphia-based journalist who's writing about the case for the impeachment of Barack Obama. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
let it ride. Lose your money, lose your pride. Easy came, easy went. Ghetto slums and tenements. Things look real Old Testament. Blame it out on the president. The emperor's got brand new clothes, and everybody but him knows he's naked. But you don't say a word. The emperor's got brand new jewels. Wake up soon, you silly fools, he's naked. But you don't say a word.
All right, welcome back. That's Everlast with his song Naked from the album Love, War, and the Ghost of Whitey Ford. And I thought that was an extremely appropriate song for our next guest, David Lindorf. Dave's a Philadelphia-based journalist. He's the author of The Case for Impeachment a number of years back, in, I think, 2006. And it was about impeaching, the case for the impeachment of Bush et al., his little gang. And he's just recently penned an article in Counterpunch called The Case for the Impeachment of Barack Obama. And guess what? According to Dave, it's very much the same. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You say that as you examine this, you wrote your book, it was 4 years ago, and you built a strong case around the need to impeach Bush et al. And these days, you say, when I mention the book's title, people sometimes ask half in jest whether I'm referring to the current president, Barack Obama. And you say, yes. Why?
Well, it's amazing how many of the Bush policies that were impeachable, either as crimes or as crimes against the Constitution, this president has continued, as well as the fact that I'm not sure how many people realize that the Geneva Conventions on war crimes make it a war crime not to punish those who are guilty of war crimes who are in your area of jurisdiction, so that if the mere fact that this president and his attorney general have stated that they will not prosecute the war crimes such as torture authorizations by Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld and you know, the whole handful of people that helped them with that, you know, Judge Bybee, John Yoo, and others, is in itself a war crime, and it's as, as serious as the actual acts of torture not to pursue the perpetrators of torture. So right there, that's a huge one. But it goes on. I mean, one of the latest thing, the word that the Obama administration is authorizing the execution, assassination, execution, what have you, of American citizens abroad, merely because they've decided in their infinite wisdom that these Americans are terrorists or non-informal combatants or whatever the term they used for it was, is a violation of the Constitution. American citizens have the presumption of innocence and the right to a trial. Mm-hmm. So there's another one. The NSA spying, which Obama as a candidate, as a senator rather, helped to preserve by his vote for immunity for the telecom companies, that was sort of a clue of what was coming, but he hasn't stopped it. It's still going on, maybe more than it was under the Bush administration, this kind of sweeping monitoring of our electronic communications.
You know, one of the things that was really heavy to me, I mean, it was that, you know, you look at this, and there's a couple of things I want to hit on what you said, but just starting with this NSA spying, a couple of things, there's the case against the Islamic Charity, and as you make the point
right.
that, you know, this
That's
was...
out in your area, right?
Yeah, yeah, up in San Francisco, actually.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that this is, you know, this was not even, this was just continued, it was rolled over, and actually, the suit was only brought... That brought about this decision saying it was illegal for them to be spying on this charity. It was only brought because somehow somebody mistakenly leaked what was going on and that the spying was being done. They leaked it to the charity, and then the case was brought. But Obama and them, and they're even thinking about appealing it. You know, and then the other thing is the Wilner case, which to me is a very heavy case where the Guantanamo lawyers, the NSA spying on the Guantanamo lawyers. You know, this is a very heavy situation. When you think about, you know, this thing of like not just mimicking, but actually developing and taking even further what his where his predecessor went. Obama is, you know, when you talk about this, the case that you've built here is actually pretty strong. And when you expand it out, you can really see a whole lot going on here.
Oh yeah, no, and even on the torture issue, he's been a little cagey about saying, you know, remember Bush said we don't torture, and then of course what he did was redefined torture
right.
to basically make it almost impossible to say anything is torture. But Obama's been a little bit facile with that too, and has left wiggle room to continue the torturing by, you know, just redefining what's torture. So he has not banned torture. And then, of course, you know, there are the actual crimes, you know, statutory crimes, because I think that it's pretty clear at this point, certainly enough to warrant a prosecutor to call a grand jury, that our treasurer, Timothy Geithner, was up to his neck in criminal involvement in hiding the manipulations of Lehman Brothers from the public, from the regulators, and from the investors. So, I mean, that's criminal activity that clearly the Obama administration has primary responsibility for. So I think Geithner should be, you know, probably prosecuted. He doesn't need to be impeached, but he can also be impeached. Members of the cabinet can be impeached, which has a lower standard of proof than actual prosecution, which is difficult, you know, because you have to show motivation and beyond a reasonable doubt, which you don't have to do with impeachment. So I think, you know, for the bank crimes, certainly you've got impeachable crimes, and then the high crimes of violating the Constitution or undermining the Constitution are just legion.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Dave Lindorf. He's a Philadelphia-based journalist whose recent article, The Case for Impeachment of Barack Obama, can be found on Counterpunch on their website. Now, Dave,
it can also be found on my website, thiscan'tbehappening.net.
The website is what?
thiscan'tbehappening.net.
Aha, very good. Very good name. I like that. I'll go there today. One of the things, when you mentioned torture, it's very interesting. Bill Quigley had an article recently talking about the ongoing torture of Syed Fahad Hashmi, who has been kept for years in prison in New York City. And not even, you know, he hasn't even gone to trial. He's got no criminal record. He hasn't gone to trial or anything. But he's been kept for 3 years in what can only be described as torture, you know, being tortured on a daily
basis.
That's
federal detention.
Yeah.
So it's again, yeah, no, that's right.
And then the opening of Bagram, not just the opening, but not just the continuation of Bagram, but they're looking to expand it.
You know, that's right.
For specifically for bringing people that they can't bring anyplace else, bringing them into Bagram.
Bagram is the new Guantanamo, actually, because what's happened is they've decided to use Bagram because it's thoroughly outside of being, you know, a U.S. territory, whereas the Bush administration tried to do this fiction that Guantanamo is Cuba, because it's leased property, but ask any Cuban if they can set foot on Guantanamo.
Right.
it's pretty difficult. So that fiction has been eroded by the courts, which have asserted that, you know, the courts have jurisdiction over Guantanamo and that it is U.S. territory. So they've basically moved their most nefarious activities, kidnapping and torture activities, to Bagram Air Base, where they already had it underway and are just expanding it to be the new Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Now let's jump into the other thing that you actually make a big case around, which I think is very important, and that's the prosecution of these wars, especially Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Let's talk about that some.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the highest crime in the Nuremberg tribunals, which were encoded in the UN Charter to which the U.S. is a signatory, was the crime of aggression and starting wars of aggression. And as the Charter states, that is the gravest crime because all the other war crimes are contained within it. And so, you know, clearly that was the greatest crime of the Bush-Cheney team, which was starting a war of aggression, defined as, in the UN Charter, a war when there is no imminent threat. And, you know, you're allowed to go to war if you think you're about to be attacked, and that's it. That's the only excuse. It's pretty clear-cut. There's no ambiguity in that one. And aggression is defined in, you know, clearly as, you know, things like attacking a country sending missiles at it, firing, dropping bombs on it, firing cannons into it, whatever. And what we're doing in Pakistan, just to, for starters, with these drone attacks, are a violation of the sovereignty of another nation. But more than that, they're actually acts of war against that nation. And you can't say, well, they're secretly approving that. I mean, Pakistan is a democracy. You know, some people will debate what kind of democracy it is, but you can make those same debates about this country. But it is a democracy. It's got a prime minister who's elected, has an elected government, and that government says it doesn't want the drone attacks. So for the U.S. to be sending these drones in and blowing people up, and they're killing more civilians than targets even, there is no imminent threat to the United States or its interests from Pakistan that can justify that. It's an act of war and it's a crime. Mm-hmm. That's one. That's a huge one. And then there's even a question with Afghanistan because, you know, there was a authorization for use of force, which was a far cry from a declaration of war, but at least it was a fig leaf that Congress gave to Bush in October of 2001 to authorize the what was called the War on Terror, and specifically this was used for the justification for sending the military in and the bombers in to go after Al-Qaeda sites in Afghanistan, and it was more broadly interpreted by the Bush administration to take on the Taliban government and oust them from power because they arguably supported the allowed the basis of the of Al-Qaeda. That was the claim. And so there you had some, as I said, fig leaf of a congressional authorization for that war in 2001. But that war was over pretty quick. Al-Qaeda was driven out of Afghanistan, and the Taliban were overthrown. Then you had elections. You had the establishment of a puppet government in Kabul. And that's the end of the authorization for use of force. There was no terrorist activity in Afghanistan at that point. There was no Taliban government. So for this war to have gone on for 8 years and for Obama to have escalated it and changed the justification to this nation-building supposedly exercise is totally without authorization. So you now have a war going on with no authorization.
Okay, Dave, we're going to have to wrap it up now, but I wanted to actually thank you very much for saying loud and clear, the emperor has no clothes, he's naked.
That's what we need to be doing. I mean, mm-hmm. It's unacceptable to say this guy is different from Bush, and so we don't have to hold him to the same standards.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, Dave, thank you very much. And your website again is?
ThisCan'tBeHappening.net.
Okay, and the article is also available on Counterpunch. So, Dave, we'll have you back again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. So long.
Bye now. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Dave Lindorf, whose latest article, The Case for Impeachment of Barack Obama, is really a compelling case and, again, is shouting loud and clear that the emperor is naked, okay, and is guilty of all kinds of crimes, war crimes, impeachable things. I want to go out with what I think is a very special song, and it's very tied up with a lot of the issues that we've posed in today's show. It's from Eugene McDaniels, and the song is called Freedom Death Dance. And when I play it, I think you'll pretty clearly get what I'm talking about here. But before we do that, I want to let you know that as I was looking for a song to close the show and came up on Eugene McDaniels' Freedom Death Dance, it posed a lot of questions in my own mind and something I wanted to talk with you about. You know, often people keep talking to me about, I know the world. Really, I really hate the way the world is today. I really despise what goes on, and I look around and I see just horror after horror, or see no hope for humanity, or just feel smothered and deadened. And I kept thinking about that because people also oftentimes say, but there's not much you can do about it. You know, it's everything from it's human nature, it's always been this way, or how can we get up out of this? And I kept thinking about how that relates to what I'm trying to do with this radio show. You know, and one of the things out here is that I really do believe that this question is one of the heaviest weights that sits on the shoulders of humanity. The idea that what we have today is just, it's necessary. It always was and it always will be. The idea that there's a permanent necessity to the way things are today, to the social relations and the production relations and the class relations and the thinking and all this kind of stuff, that all that is permanently necessary. It's just a part of the human condition. You know, and I think actually, I mean, what I believe is I believe that everything that we're in today, these are historically conditioned relations, historically conditioned social relations, class relations, production relations, and even the way we think, historically and socially conditioned. You know, and what this show, I kept thinking about, okay, well, how does this show tie into all that? And I wanted to share this with you because I think it's important. You know, once we understand the way things work, then we open up a whole lot of doorways to a whole different future. And that's what I try to do with this show. It's, you know, I look around and I know the world cries out more than ever before in human history for radical and revolutionary change. But that's not enough, you know, and I think actually because people then have to do something. I always used to say, you know, but what we do in relation to that, to getting a different world, that's key and that's true. But in order to even be able to do, we have to understand how things work. What are the interconnections between things? And once we understand how these things work, then we can see the way out of it. And that's what this show is about. I have all kinds of guests on this show, both to inspire people with a different possibility, but also to let people know that this possibility isn't pie in the sky, that it's actually related to the kinds of things that exist in the society, the conditions, and the possibility to transform those conditions, not just the necessity. We know that things must change, but also the possibility they must and can change. So with that in mind, I'm wrapping up another show and looking forward to talking to you again next week. I want to thank my engineer, G. I want to thank Henry Carson for his production assistance, Age for his production assistance, and most of all, each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Now keep in mind all the stuff that I just talked with you about, and I'll be back to talk to you again next week. But keep in mind all the stuff as you're listening to this song, Eugene McDaniel's Freedom Death Dance.
Everybody wants happiness. Everybody wants peace of mind. Everybody says we should ignore the graves we dance upon. But I've really got news for you. There's no amount of dancing we can do.